Welcome to Foundation. For more episodes, check out foundation.kr. Today we're talking to Jim Gilliam, who is the founder and CEO of Nation Builder, and he's also a two-time cancer survivor. Let's chat with him. So I always like to start at the beginning and ask where you grew up.
So my family moved out to Silicon Valley when I was about four. We'd lived in upstate New York in Woodstock. My parents were most certainly not hippies. My dad worked at IBM, so he came out to Silicon Valley to work at the Almaden Research Center. It had just been set up in Almaden. And just by happenstance, we happened to move into a subdivision, brand new, that was right across the street from this giant mega church. And that was my introduction to the Valley.
And so IBM, your dad had to have, I guess, PCs at home, right? Is that like, was that your first experience? Was like as a little kid, like looking and seeing like, oh, there's a PC, I should play with this. Like, how did you get involved with computers?
So yeah, so when we were in Woodstock, IBM announced their first PC. It was the answer to the Apple II. Right? So this is like 1981 or so. And all of the employees sort of had the opportunity to get on the waiting list to get one of these computers, and they cost like $5,000. And eventually he got his notice that he could like pick his up. And my dad was kind of cheap, and he knew that it was gonna cost like hundreds of dollars in sales tax if he bought it in New York. So we drove to Nashua, New Hampshire, to Computerland. I was like in the car with him, vaguely remember this.
What is Computerland? That sounds amazing.
Computerland? Oh, yes. You don't remember? Oh,
so no.
Computerland was
Disneyland for computers.
It was the computer store, right? Like that, it was all of the. I mean, there were probably several hundred of them.
I was a Computer City user and a CompUSA user. Those were my.
So yeah, so this is a little bit before then. I don't know what happened to Computerland. I mean, I guess it went virtual or something. I don't know. But yeah, so there was a fair number of these stores, and. He put it into the trunk. It was a brown Ford Pinto. The computer probably cost more than the car.
That's amazing. And so that was like a 8088 or 8086, like an old school five and a quarter.
It was an 8088, no hard drive, two the 5 1/4 inch floppy drives. We later got a computer that had a 10 meg hard drive. That was an 8086. That was really, we were living it up then. Yeah,
that's awesome. So you basically, did you learn how to program then, or was it more just playing around with games and things like that?
So my dad was a genius computer programmer. He was just phenomenal. The old IBM computers, they had this sort of clickety clack on them that was just like resonate throughout the whole house. That tactile feedback was just amazing. So I would like sit next to him and watch him like code on the screen. I'd ask like, so, you know, what is that? What is DIR? What is that? Like, he would sort of explain to me like sort of the basic DOS things and whatnot. I never really started programming kind of at that age. It was a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. And now you said one of the things I want to bring up, because in your talk I was kind of fascinated by this because I had a very similar background, but you also were raised, you mentioned the mega church. So like you said church and computers were like your two big things as a youth. Is that correct?
Yeah, so my family or my parents like met at church, and so they were sort of religious, but like not really into it. But then when we moved out to San Jose, it just really, the whole tenor of religion changed sort of the family pretty dramatically. They got just really involved in this church, the Los Gatos Christian Church. It's still there, although it's called something else now. There was a whole scandal with the pastor in the 80s.
It happens.
Shocking, I know. But he was really radicalized, my dad, there was some stuff around this guy named John MacArthur, who was a big, he was basically like, there are all these people who think that they're Christians and they're really not. So it was just, you know, in thinking back on it, it was just a really interesting to see someone with such an amazing technical engineering mind would get so wrapped up in something as sort of mushy as faith. So that's been a kind of a fascinating thing for me, obviously.
Now, did your parents allow you to go online? I know I had, personally, I know my mom was always kind of looking over my shoulder, really concerned about like what I would find on these bulletin board systems and things like that. Like, how was that for you, and when did you first find yourself getting connected to the internet?
So my parents were very strict, as you can imagine. I was homeschooled for a fair amount of time, the purpose of which was to sort of shield me from the corrupt outside world. So naturally, the online world was, I gravitated to it pretty strongly. My dad sort of let slip. Again, sort of the computers were there and I was sort of interested and it was interesting, but it was only when like he let slip that they could actually like talk to each other, because he had this modem that he brought home from work. And it was for that first computer that we had, the one that didn't have the hard drive. And he started, you know, playing around with it, and I started asking him sort of what it was. And he's like, well, it's a modem, it connects to other computers. I'm like, whoa. Computers can connect with each other? Right? And that kind of set me off for a while, trying to figure out, okay, how do we, you know, how does that actually work? And like, how can I connect to other computers myself? Mm-hmm. I found Computer Shopper magazine. Do you remember Computer Shopper?
The big, thick the catalog. Big, yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah. It's like 1,000 pages. And it was 99% ads for every computer mail order in the world.
Motherboards, RAM prices, all that stuff.
Completely. And but in the back, there were like a few handful of pages with listings of bulletin board systems, right, in all the different area codes. And by this time, we were living in North Carolina. Is when I finally got connected to the BBSs. This is probably around like 9 or 8 or 9 or 10, something like that. And I found one. I think there was only one, maybe two BBSs in Durham that I could call with a local phone call. Mm-hmm. And that was how I first got connected. And it was kind of all over after that.
Yeah. So take me forward from there. Like, how did your career progress from there, like in computers?
So I would spend most of my time online. I wouldn't do any of my schoolwork, my homeschool work. I kind of really...
Can you just cheat when it comes to that kind of stuff? Like, I always wondered about the homeschool students. Like, do you really... You don't have to turn it in, right? Like, I guess, like...
No, I mean, try cheating with your parents or the teacher.
Right.
It's just, that doesn't work. Like, right. you can fool teachers, you can't fool your parents. But I didn't like biology and science and physics, all that stuff. Like, I did the math well enough. I would do it quickly, and I would make them happy. They were both math majors. But then I would spend all night online, and I would, like, fall asleep in the middle of the day. My mom was like, what's going on? Right? It's like, oh, yeah. Spending all night on the computer. They would take it away all the time.
Same way.
I would figure out how to, like, unlock it. Right, and while they were
gone,
they had the lock. They thought that was somehow going to stop me.
That's right.
Right,
it was just connected to the jumper inside.
Yeah. It's just like you just take it off and. Yeah. So naturally, I got sort of more and more involved. I ended up going to Liberty University, and this is Jerry Falwell's school, university. If you know who Jerry Falwell is, but he's a big evangelical televangelist type person. He died a few years ago. And my parents sort of forced me into doing this. I didn't really want to, but the side effect was that when I went there, they only had two computers. This is 96, 95. There's only two computers in the entire school that had the internet. So I found them. And my first experience, the first week that I'm at Liberty, by the way, Liberty, just let that sink in for a moment, that's what the place is called. I go there and I find the two computers, and remember how Netscape, in order to like edit your bookmark file, it was an HTML file,
right?
And so-
Sure, it still is, actually.
So I was editing my bookmark file on the computer in like Notepad, and the administrator of the library comes in and he's like, what are you doing? He like pulls me aside, right? And they think that I'm hacking the computer from editing my bookmark file. And they brought me into the other administrator, right? And they were like trying to figure out what to do with me. I'm like, you don't understand. I'm just editing my book work file. They had no idea what I'm talking about. And eventually, I totally break down. I start crying, and they finally believe me. I'm like, what is wrong with this place? And they connected me to their new academic computing director, who had come in, and he was like the computer guy that was going to figure out how to bring computers to campus. And now all of a sudden, I had access to dozens and dozens of computers. I set the internet up for the whole campus, and I got to play around with many computers instead of just my one connected to a modem.
Mm-hmm. Were you studying computer science at university, or?
The computer science at Liberty was like, what? It's just not, yeah. I studied history there briefly, but I wasn't there very long because that's when I got cancer.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what happened? When did you find out?
So I started at Liberty as a sophomore, and I was there for about a semester and a half. And spring break is rolling around, and I had a really difficult time breathing. Like, I couldn't, like, lay down at all to go to sleep. And so I went to the university doctor, and they thought it was, like, bronchitis. Eventually, we find out that it's a lot more serious than that. You know, 9 months later or so, after about 9 rounds of chemo, it was over. And it was at that point where I was like, okay, I'm not going to mess around with school anymore. Life is very precious. And this internet thing, I love it. So I went and I moved to Boston. Actually, just north of Boston in Salisbury, Massachusetts, to work at a startup there. It was the first startup that I worked at. It was called Archive Technologies. And then 6 months later, I found out that I had cancer again. And the good news was that I was now in Boston, and they had some really great hospital there, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. It's very, very well known. I was able to get a bone marrow transplant from an anonymous donor. And you know, now it's sort of, you know, even more motivated to make an impact. The startup never really went anywhere. Funding fell through, that kind of thing, but I ended up at Lycos, which was one of the first search engines. This is about 1998. And that was a crazy time. Lycos at the time was the fastest company to ever go public. Right, the whole concept behind it was that they took this technology from Carnegie Mellon, which was based in Pittsburgh, and they hired a sales guy, CEO, Bob Davis, and they built a portal out of it. And it was the whole portal wars, the Yahoo, Excite.
They had the dog right? icon, right?
We had the dog, yeah. Go get it, right? That was our slogan.
Were you a product manager there? What role did you fall into?
So I was a coder. I did web stuff. They basically made a position for me. I was the integration team. And the idea with the integration team was that there were like all of these different product managers that were doing all of these deals with like, you know, AutoByTel and all of these different companies. And the idea was to create as much inventory as possible that was co-branded with Lycos. Because all we were doing is we had salespeople going out there selling banner ads. Mm-hmm. And so the more inventory we had, you know, coming through our search engine and then out into, if we were sending people to all of these sites with our own ads on them, then we would make more and more money, right? Mm-hmm. And the problem was that we couldn't get any of these co-branded sites to be in the actual search engine. So we were sending people to AutoByTel, but it wasn't the Lycos.AutoByTel, right? And so we were missing out on all that stuff. So I sort of quickly found out this was a problem. We started to do things to integrate more and more of the Lycos type properties like into the search results. So it was everything from sports scores, you know, news, all the stuff that you see now, like that pops up in Google when you search for different things, all of the kind of the fancy stuff, the movie show times.
Sure.
Right. That was all the kind of stuff that we were doing. We did it, you know, in the late 90s. Yeah.
And was this, so when you were at Lycos, you said then you were re-diagnosed with cancer after you were at Lycos for a while?
When I was at Lycos, I was fine. It was two times in that first startup right before Lycos. But by the time I got to Lycos, everything was cool.
Okay.
And I was cancer-free, and I stayed cancer-free for years. Yeah.
And so you then focused on just, did you ever go back to, want to go back to school at all? Or was it just like, I'm just going to...
Oh, no, it was that? Like, oh, it was like, game on.
How does that change right. your perspective on things? Like, if you're sitting there and you've gone through this, like, I can imagine, like, hellish, like, several years of chemo and bone marrow transplant, like, what how did you feel different coming out of that and what to pursue and what to spend your time on?
Well, for me at that point, it was, you know, all of society, all my parents, everyone was saying, like, you've got to go to college, right? And if you go to college, then you can get a good job. This whole idea of you know, dropping out of Harvard and doing a startup thing was, like, not a thing at all. And so the whole idea that I was going to not do that and I was just going to follow my passion on the internet was, like, it was not clear at all that that was going to work. So getting a job at Lycos with no college degree and, like, no real formal training at all. Like, I didn't even have a high school degree, right? High school diploma. That was sort of shocking in and of itself. And that, you know, I ended up being the CTO of business.com and I was like 22. So it was, you know, going through that and just doing it because I really loved to do it. Was exciting, but then it was only later when I realized, oh wow, I'm actually good at this.
Right.
And so now it matters what I do it for.
How do you convince someone like a business.com, which was really well-known property back then, like to become the CTO? Like, were you constantly reading technical books? Like, how do you get your chops up? Obviously, they're looking at a whole pool of candidates when they're looking to hire someone. They have, you know, MBAs, college grads. Like, how do you appear, rise to the top, and then get the position?
So that's a funny story. You don't apply, is what happened. So when I was at Lycos, Sangam was our VP of engineering, and this other guy, Shamit Baluja, who I believe actually works at Google now. He's a researcher, he's a brilliant guy. He was our chief scientist. They decided that they were going to move out to LA to be the tech team behind eCompanies. So eCompanies was one of the first incubators. It was our big competition was Idea Lab, which is still around. And they were like, okay, well, we need somebody who actually knows how to get shit done. So that's Jim. So they brought me with them. And so we came out to LA, and the idea was that, you know, we would help all of these different companies with their technology stack. And help them grow. And our big flagship company at eCompanies was business.com. We paid $7.5 million for this domain name, the most anybody ever spent on domain, right? This was Jake Weinbaum and Sky Dayton's big thing. So Sky Dayton had done Earthlink, was his big claim to fame, and Jake had come from Disney. And so, you know, we hired a team in to do business.com, and we have a big consulting firm called US Interactive. There was like 30 people that had been hired. We were paying them millions of dollars to build out the site. And we were supposed to launch, and it was a total disaster. They were nowhere, they couldn't even publish pages out. It was a total disaster. And Jake asked me to fix it. He's like, Jim, can you fix it? I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, you have 17 days. I need a directory and a search engine. It needs to work. Otherwise, we are totally screwed. And that was the most intense 17 days of my entire life. It was insane. We had all of this. We had built all of these servers out. We had all these HP machines. We had this gigantic, like, Oracle database server and all this stuff. This was back when this, like, the hardware to power a site like business.com cost literally millions of dollars. And so I was spent all these nights down at Exodus, which was our hosting facility in El Segundo.
Racking your own servers and everything.
Yep, racking the servers and reconfiguring them all to use a completely different architecture and stuff like that. And so that's how you end up being the CTO when you're a kid, is that they have no other option. Mm-hmm. And you're the only one that knows how to get it done.
Where did you take it from there? What did you decide to do next?
9/11 happened. That was the big thing for me. So this is fall of 2011 or 2001. that was the moment where I realized, oh, wow, okay, like, I can actually do this thing. I can not go to college. Like, I can be successful doing the thing that I love. Now it actually matters what I do it for. And I had absolutely no idea what that was. I'd never spent any time trying to figure out what it is that I actually cared about. I just went. So I left. It was a big epiphany for me was understanding that I wasn't going to know what that next thing was until my head was clear. And so I just had to remove myself from the situation, and then maybe I would figure it out. So about a year and a half or so into it is when I was getting really upset about the lead up to the Iraq War. It just it didn't make any sense to me at all. Turned out it didn't make sense, period. But the because I live in Los Angeles, I connected with a filmmaker. His name is Robert Greenwald, and he'd made a bunch of television movies. He'd won like Emmys. He had like Sally Field in his movies. And he wanted to make this documentary about the Iraq War. And so I was like, sure, I'd love to get involved. I'd had set up this blog, and so that was sort of my calling. He had absolutely no idea any of the tech background. It meant absolutely nothing to him, right? He just saw my blog where I'd been like obsessively documenting all of the things that the Bush administration had been saying. He's like, yeah, okay, sure, you can research this documentary. I'll pay you $500 a week. And four really crazy intense months after that, this is in 2003, sort of shortly after mission accomplished had been declared, we released a documentary. And it was the kind of film that the whole reason we were making it was because the traditional media wasn't covering this story. Mm-hmm. So we had to get really creative with how we distributed it.
YouTube was just launched at that time?
YouTube was
2003?
No. YouTube was like more like 2005, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it was 2005 or so. So this was back in like, we had $2,000 streaming media bills for like a 320 pixel video, right? And I had to encode it in QuickTime, Windows Movie, and Real Media, right? So what we did was, and you couldn't just distribute the film online either. You had to actually create DVDs. It just wasn't practical. So we did a partnership with MoveOn.org. MoveOn.org is quite famous now. They're a huge force in the liberal politics. But at the time, they'd just really been getting going and had been activating people around the war. They're about 1 million members. And we went to them and said, hey, you know, they sent an email out to their whole list saying, you know, here's a documentary. We think it's great. But if you donate $30, we'll give you a free copy of the movie. And then that money will go to fund these anti-Bush ads. And we thought, well, you know, maybe a couple thousand people or whatever would do this. And a couple of thousand people did it in like an hour. And in the course of 3 days, we'd sold, I think, about 30,000 DVDs. We'd raised close to $1 million for these Bush ads. And we were just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And we didn't have 30,000 DVDs. So it actually takes a while to print 30,000 DVDs. And so MoveOn then had this other just genius idea, which was to take all the DVDs that we had a few thousand, and distribute those to people first who could host a screening, like in their house or at their church or at their place of work or whatever. And then that would be the way that we could get the word out about this film like as fast as possible. So they coordinated all of these screenings through a website. We had like 2,000 screenings of this film uncovered within weeks of when we had finished the film. This led to like this just massive set of screenings all over the world. Activists, like the word genuinely got out, right, about what had been going on. It was just a real, it was a story that really needed to be told. And you know, we used the internet and organizing, mm-hmm. community organizing, as a way to do it. So we made a few more films after that based on that same principle.
Was this the first time you'd really considered like and seen the power of the internet coming together to help like move groups of people to around a cause, or?
Yeah, and it was like in the real world too. right? It wasn't just online, like lots of clicks and people and numbers like moving up and higher and like view counts and things like that. It was like, I went to our first screening in Santa Monica at this indie theater, and the line was like around the block for our movie. And it was, you know, it was probably not a lot of filmmakers in this audience, but like when you go to like your own movie and you see, and the place is packed with people watching it, it is the most amazing experience ever. And these people came to see this thing that we just like went crazy on. So when you're doing it, when you can have that experience, you get that experience a little bit when you like build technology, right? Because you know, at Lycos, we had a million people that would like use some change that we made like in the course of a day. And that was like really exhilarating, but you never saw anything.
Right, it's not really tangible.
Right, but when 500 people show up in this theater, and they're like clapping and laughing, and you're there, and like it's just a totally different experience. And so that was a big, that was the, you know, internet going online to offline thing. That was a big, big thing for me.
How did you decide to take that and move it into your current startup? Like, what happened between then and now?
So we made a couple more films. Out Fox was about the Fox News. Using the same model, we made a movie called Walmart, The High Cost of a Price, again, based on this model. We created a whole nonprofit media company called Brave New Films, and we're like, okay, this is a thing, community organizing to distribute documentary films. We built a big membership, and we even got to the point where for our fourth film, we crowdfunded it before that was a thing. We raised over $250,000 to fund this, A Rock for Sale. It was a movie about war profiteering. And it was in that process, I got sick again. found out that the treatments, the chemo and the radiation from the cancer had slowly gotten to the point where my lungs were scarred and I couldn't breathe. This was around the time when the Walmart film came out. So this is 2005, fall 2005. And so I find out that I need this transplant. So I'm a geek, right? So I go online. All the stats are published on the UNOS website. They're responsible for all the organ transplants in the country. And they publish them all. So I'm like digging through the stats. I find that UCLA has the best survival rates on the West Coast, and they do the most, right? So clearly, this is the place that I want to go.
You're talking about for a lung transplant.
For lung transplants, yeah. So the way that it works is you need to get approved and on the list at a particular program. So the program has to accept you. And there are maybe like 60 or so programs in the United States, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. But there were three in the sort of Southern California area, USC, UCLA, and Cedars. And UCLA does far and away the most. I'm like, okay, this is the place to go. They also had a special technique that allowed them to use more lungs than a lot of the other transplant programs used as well. So I submitted my file to them, like I was applying for college, finally. And they just took one look at it, and they just said, forget it, right? You're not a good candidate. The surgery is going to be extremely difficult. You've had cancer before, right? You're probably, you know, what happens when you get a lung transplant is they have to suppress your immune system for the rest of your life. And so you're more susceptible to illness, to things like cancer coming back. So I was very upset about this. And so I went online, naturally. My stepmom had set up this blog called checkonjim.com. And we knew this was going to be a bit of an ordeal. So she had been keeping everybody informed of sort of where we were in the process. And when we got this news that they weren't going to accept me, I went on the blog and I said, UCLA surgeons are pussies. And I went to my friend was going to register the domain name. It was like a whole movement was about ready to get started. And one of the volunteers at Brave New Films, actually with a woman, one of the women who had watched Fox News like 24/7 to help with the Out Fox film, she saw this. And she first chastised me for my language. And then she sent an email to just the generic UCLA at Med Center email address, accusing them of only doing easy surgeries to artificially inflate their statistics. And then like my sister sent in an email, a few other people sent emails, all posting in the comments of the blog saying they'd done this. So I'm like, oh, this is, thanks, guys. It's really sweet. 2 weeks later, I get a call from the scheduler at UCLA, just totally matter of fact. Be like, hey, so I need to set you up on an appointment. I'm like, what are you talking about? Right, you guys rejected me already. You must be mistaken, right? He's like, no, you're on my list, right? You need an appointment. I'm like, of course. So we don't know what's going on. I go in, I meet with one of the doctors, and they're like, yeah, everything's fine. Eventually, I meet with the surgeon, right? The main guy, the person who's in charge of the whole program. And I asked him what had happened. And he said, look, I never saw your file, but I did get the emails. And they're absolutely right. This is going to be a very, very difficult surgery, which is exactly why I need to be the one who does it. And a year later, I got the transplant. And that was now just a little over 6 years ago.
Wow. And that's, you go from there to wanting to jump back into a job? Like,
so I worked during this whole process. So when we did the Iraq for Sale fundraiser, I sent an email from my bed. I'm like, guys, I was telling my stepmom, I was like, I have to write a $200,000 email right now. It's like, okay, whatever. And so I worked during that entire process. I mean, you can make a movie from your bed. You can produce, whatever that means. Yeah.
Do you feel like, was this something that was like, just kind of like, was work an outlet for you?
Yeah.
To just kind of take your mind off of things?
Yeah, I mean, that and I watched a lot of Grey's Anatomy, but it was absolutely. I mean, I worked all of the illnesses that I had, even with the cancer, you know, aside from the part when you're like throwing up, like I was working. Because it was just, it's not working. You just loved it. Mm-hmm. We had to like fight to get modem access when I was at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Things like that. So it's certainly, I mean, yeah, if you're sick, like, and you have any ability to sort of stay online, I know a lot of people do, but it's really helpful to kind of do something. In fact, they'll tell you, like, even if you don't have a hobby, to like pick up a hobby. Yeah, definitely.
So you've created, let's fast forward to today and what you're working on now. I mean, you've created a pretty big movement, as Rick said earlier. Like, tell me about your project today.
So the idea is to take, you know, the stuff that we had done at Brave New Films with organizing people around the films, the stuff that I had experienced in my own life with people organizing to save my life, and make it broadly accessible to everybody. So the challenge, you know, community organizing has existed for an extremely long period. I mean, you know, Moses was a community organizer. He's like the original community organizer, right? He's like, he's standing up to the Pharaoh. He's telling a story. He's like, get my people out of here, right? I mean, that's community organizing. And so the challenge is when you try to do this online, there's like the technology world has created all of the individual pieces. So we've got the event tools and the email marketing tools and the CMS and the CRM and all these different things. But if you want to organize people, you have to mush it all together into something. And so because I'd had all this tech background, I could just hack it all together when I was at Brave New Films, right? But, you know, or if you're, say, Obama, right, you can hire people, you can spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and you can do all this stuff. But the whole purpose of community organizing is for folks that don't have power to come together and accomplish something that they could never have accomplished alone. And the ability to do that online, the potential is just massive, except that you've got to have like all of these tech skills in order to pull it off. And so it's completely out of the reach of the average person. So what we wanted to do is figure out how could we make these tools broadly accessible. So I mean, you know, affordable, easy to use, all of that stuff. You know, bring the Silicon Valley product-oriented mindset to this problem and make it available to the whole world. Turn everybody into a leader.
So is this just like a suite of tools? Like, is it everything from, you know, a blog to a newsletter to, you know, how to set up your Twitter account? Like, how do you figure out what kind of handholding do you offer and what kind of tools did you build?
So it's a fairly difficult problem because you don't want it to be just the sum of all of the individual parts.
Right.
You want to synthesize it into something that's new, that is easy to understand, and that's our like big challenge. We sort of work on it constantly all the time. But fundamentally, what we did is we took the CMS and the CRM, which generally are just completely separate things that everybody has to connect together when you want to organize. Because you need to have your website, and you need to have a people database, right? And we just synthesize it together, and we call it a community organizing system. And that's the core of it. So your website and your people database are one and the same. The thing that you are organizing around is not content, right? It's people. And if you think about it, it's sort of obvious. Like, why, you know, it makes sense why we started with content, because a website, web pages, it's all very content oriented. But really, what all we really care about, particularly if you're a leader trying to organize people, is you care about the people, right? The content in the stories is all wrapped around that, but it's the people that actually matter. And so what we've been doing is we provide that platform. We get a lot of customers who just purely need like the basics. Like, they need a website with donations and an email list. And that is actually really hard for the average person to put together without Nation Builder, right? You get like WordPress, and then you get like your PayPal account set up. You try to like hack that in, like it gets a little widget code, you like plug it in there, right? And then you go to like MailChimp or Constant Contact, and you get the little widget code, you plug that in. And you're really excited and proud of yourself. Look at this thing, I set this up, it's amazing. And all these donations start coming in. And you're like, great, okay, so now I want to send an email to all the people who donated, thanking them. And you realize you have three different databases of people. That's the experience that most people have with this stuff. Yeah. And that's just the basics. So we scoop up a lot of folks just by solving that basic problem. But it goes so much deeper than that, where it's about, you know, if you're trying to organize a movement, right? I personally can talk to a certain number of people. Like, I have a phone conversation with maybe a few hundred people a week. Right? Mm-hmm. But you can't build a movement if you can only talk to a few hundred people a week. Mm-hmm. So what you've got to do is you've got to find and build a leadership capacity in those few hundred people that you talk to, and then they go and they talk to other people as well.
So you're building tools for those people to go out and talk to the masses.
Exactly, yeah. So Obama did this, you know, at a massive scale, right? And it was extremely effective. Where, you know, basically what they did is they built out this massive organization, all volunteers, almost all entirely people that weren't paid, who were able to tell a story about why they were involved in the Obama campaign, and they brought more people in. And then the trained organizers would then test people, right? They would say, hey, you know, can you bring 10 people to the canvas on Friday, right? And if they did, they would give them a little more responsibility. They would be the Friday canvas captain. Right, and then they would be responsible for a larger area, in a larger area, and then you kind of keep building out this whole network and organization of people trying to identify who the leaders are, testing them, and giving them more and more responsibility. In order to do that, you've got to be able to hold people accountable, and it's sort of doesn't make sense that you could, the idea that you can hold volunteers accountable, but the reason that they are there. It's because they want to know that they are being effective and that they are not wasting their time. And so when you're really explicit, like, okay, our goal is to get this person elected president. In order to do that, we need to get 50 million votes, or whatever it is, right? So that means that we need to win this state. In order to win this state, we need, you know, 10 million votes, right? And this region, this section, we need to get this many votes. And then your little thing that you're going to do this weekend, if we don't get 100 people that say to say yes, that we're going to vote, then we're screwed. And so you connect it all the way back down to something that I can do right now that I have to do. Otherwise, this guy is not going to get elected and like the whole world's going to come to an end. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the power of organizing. And the thing is it applies to everything. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it is core to what the internet can provide. Right, that this whole, like all the social media, all the connectedness, all the stuff that we've put together, all it is just laying the foundation, right, so that we can organize.
How do you figure out, like, that totally makes sense to me when you're talking about political campaigns, because there's clearly, like, a clear cut and dry goal of I want to get this person elected, right? And you have a series of objectives to obtain that goal, and that all makes sense. But what about, like, when there's these more kind of broader, kind of like not well-defined goals of like McDonald's is using too many growth hormones in their beef, and so I want to organize, you know, several million people to stop eating McDonald's. Like, or Anonymous, I want to get a group of people together to, like, blow up some cars. I don't know what they do, but that's a bad example. That was horrible. But I guess, you see what I'm saying?
Like, I understand.
A lot of, like, very right. loose, like...
That's the key. The key there is it can't be loose.
Right.
You've got to take it and you got to say, okay, right, Anonymous, what we're going to do, in order, our theory, this is called a theory of change. Right. This is, I think, a very common, you'll hear this in a lot of activist circles, the theory of change. How is it that, what is it that I'm going to do that's going to lead to something occurring in the world? Right. So with a campaign for president, it's sort of, it's very clear. We're going to get this person elected.
Right.
That person is then going to do something that's going to change the world. Right. So for growth hormones in McDonald's food, right, the example would be, okay, if we put enough pressure on all of these local Walmarts, Walmart's policy will then change and they will no longer buy these types of growth hormones or meet with these kinds of growth hormones.
McDonald's, yeah.
Right. That would be a very clear theory of change. If we get enough people to do this, and so then you can go and you can say, hey, you know, I want you to go and get 10 people to send an email or show up at McDonald's and protest or whatever, and that's going to lead to this thing occurring.
Does your tool ever get to that point to where it can be used for something outside of political campaigns? Like, I feel like that's the problem with Twitter in my mind is we have, like, so many... you know, great tweets that come across that get retweeted 10,000 plus times, but there's nothing that's actionable at the end. It's just a lot of chatter. Like, how do you turn that chatter into something that's actually actionable? And do you think that your platform is going to be the way that people will be able to, like, go to that to organize?
That's exactly the point, right? Is that what we've done is we've connected everybody, Facebook, Twitter, we've created communications channels, right, for all of this stuff to bubble up. But the next step of actually turning that into accomplishing something is the part that's missing, mm-hmm. right? And so, yeah, that's absolutely what the purpose of Nation Builders. And that's why you need to have the communications channels connected really closely with the people database and the websites, because the website becomes the place where you do the stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? So our content management system isn't really content. It's more like these action pages, right? So we'll have like a petition page or event pages or a calendar where anybody can submit their own events. Right, so the protests that are going to happen or the sit-ins or all of the screenings for all of our films mm-hmm. right, are all going to be coordinated through this website, and that becomes the hub. And then all of the activity happening on Facebook and Twitter and these other places, email is a big thing. Don't ever underestimate the power of email for organizing. Those all kind of come together and collapse around your site, and then you can track all of the things that are happening in your database.
Will this ever be like an open marketplace where I can use my mobile phone to go in, launch the application and say, I'll take, you know, a little bit of Anonymous, a little bit of growth hormone, like, and like choose the things that I want to become a part of and then get notifications and pushes and like alerts of this is what I need to do to actually take part in these? Or is it kind of more one-off? I have to find them. Like, how do I find out about these various campaigns that are going on?
So there's a few other sites. I mean, it's not something that we do, the discovery element of it. Mm-hmm. There are sites that do this, you know, things like change.org sort of provide a kind of very lightweight, okay, I care about these things. Causes, is this something that's popular on Facebook? What we're doing is our approach is a lot more, it would be more traditionally like an enterprise software model where there are organizations and there are leaders who do this. Like, this is the thing that they do, is they're trying to bring people together to do it. And what we found is that it is really important that ownership over the data and the website and the whole experience is owned and by the organizer, by the leader. You know, there's a part of it is necessary, but also part of it is just purely ego, right? There's a reason why, you know, hospitals are named after people, right? And buildings and foundations have people's names on them, is that you want it to be, it's your thing, right? There's a reason why there's like gazillions of nonprofits and there's not just one environmental nonprofit. But as a result, they're extremely motivated to make this thing happen, right? Because it's their thing, they are the leader. And so what we found works really well are less these sort of Tumblr-esque kinds of networks, mm-hmm. right? And what works is like individual websites powered by email lists mm-hmm. And some social media to bring people together. And because an individual user isn't going to show up on like your nonprofit website, right? Or and just be like, hey, so what's going on today? Like, tell me what to do.
Right.
You've got to reach out to them, you've got to connect with them, you've got to organize them, and you'd be like, hey, our theory of change is we are going to like do this, and it's going to cause this to happen. the thing that you need to do right now is click this button and go to this thing.
Right. Yeah. Well, since I have you here, I want to ask you one last question, and then we can open up to open mic here for if anyone has questions. But I'm curious, I'm really fascinated by this, like these headless organizations like Anonymous. Like, what are your thoughts on this and how they operate? And like, is that like something that you study or you're curious about? I mean,
yeah, so yes, I spent a lot of time thinking about, in fact, you know, Occupy Wall Street would be a good
right.
example. There's a certain model which is nobody is a leader, right? They were actually, like, in fact, Occupy Wall Street really embodied that principle very aggressively. Like, no one is in charge, right? This radical consensus building kind of thing. And the real failure, I think, of that to really take off was because there were no leaders. Right, so the there was nobody ever saying, like, this is the thing that we were supposed to do. I think that was a disaster. Then, on the other hand, you have something like Anonymous, right, where anybody can be a leader, right? There's just this vague, like, grouping and branding around it. But it looks very similar for the outside, right, as an organizing principle, like Anonymous and Occupy. But what's amazing about Occupy is that all somebody has to do is say, hey, I think this thing should happen. Right, they put it out there, and folks want to do it. They do it, boom, and it happens. And that sort of free marketplace mm-hmm. of leadership is something that the internet is really, really loves. And I think it goes to the DNA of those two different groups. Like, the DNA of Occupy was very much out of the sort of anarchist, sort of 70s, sort of kind of like culture of this radical consensus building kind of thing. Whereas the DNA of Anonymous. It's all the internet. It's like intuitive. It's kids who've grown up, like, who are younger than me, who've grown up where this is the only thing that they knew, and it's just so obvious how it's supposed to happen. So that's really exciting to me. Is that's the model that I believe will work. And it doesn't obviously have to be, right, sort of the aims and the principles of Anonymous, because it can apply to anything. Mm-hmm. But this idea that, you know, it's not about asking for permission. Anybody can be a leader. Right. All you got to do is find the 500, a million other people that want to do this thing, and you can just go and do it. And that requires a mindset shift that's pretty dramatic. And the younger you are, the more that the internet is baked into your DNA, the more intuitive and obvious it is. And so that's what's really exciting to me about things like Anonymous.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show. Appreciate it. And does anyone have any questions? We have open mic.
Hi, I have a question. You mentioned earlier that you had no desire to go back to your formal education and instead pursue your passion for something online-based. And I was curious, with your experience, if you had any opinion on the educational sector as a whole, especially now when we have these great tools like Coursera and Code Academy, and if you had any opinion on that in general.
Yeah, I really wish I had it when I was a kid. If I had Google when I was a kid, it's amazing the stuff that you can learn online now. The thing that I would really look at is the unschooling movement. I was effectively unschooled just because I was so stubborn I wouldn't do what my parents told me to do. But just the thing that really pains me about the education system is that we take young kids who are fundamentally curious and excited about the world, and we teach them how to hate everything about learning, right? And as a result, like, it's all about, the story we're telling them is it's all about, you know, taking whatever it is that you might be able to stand to do for the rest of your life that's going to make you the most money. And they go to college, and they do the whole rat race thing. They take a lot of debt. Because it's all going to pay off ultimately in that really high-paying job, and they're going to have 2.5 kids and the white picket fence. And then they graduate, and they just find out that it's sort of not what they were told was going to happen. And then all of a sudden, everybody says, well, you're entitled. Oh, the kids are entitled these days, right? Well, yeah, we did what you told us to do, right? And it didn't play out that way. And what the internet wants is that we have to compete globally. It's like we have to find that thing that is uniquely us, that thing that only we can do that nobody else can. And the internet gives us the opportunity to then share that with the world. And if education was designed more to help us find that thing that we love doing, as soon as we possibly could, it would change the whole world. And getting from here to there is, I don't know how to do it. I really hope we figure it out, because this compulsory education of children is destroying so much. It's really, really bad. It's destroying the creativity of all of the young minds. And I, at some level, you know, I feel lucky having, you know, my parents did it for like all the wrong reasons. Like, they homeschooled me to like keep me away from like all of these, you know, to keep me away from being creative, to like sort of control and try to make me think a certain way. But because of the internet, I kind of escaped it. But the advantage is that, like, my mind wasn't as molded by the traditional way of thinking about things. And that ended up working out well for me.
You're obviously very talented in tech background. One of the questions, a lot of people notice something when it's not right, or like, they'll notice the Walmart, but they won't really do anything about it. So why did you decide to leverage your talents? What was that real burning desire within you to actually do something about it? And yeah, just your thoughts on that.
So there's something about somebody else giving you their bone marrow or their lungs that makes it extremely clear that your time on this earth is a gift. You know, I can say that to folks, and everybody knows that they're gonna die someday, right? And that's, your time is precious, it's a cliche, right? It's all understood intellectually, we understand it. And so you shouldn't waste any time at all. It's completely different when, like, people died for that. And the debt and that I feel around it, not of money, but of life, is pretty deep. And I've got to figure out how I try to repay that. So that's what I've been trying to do. And it was a lot of what the speech was about, that the internet is my religion, a lot of that was about me sort of understanding that there was nothing that I could ever do that would be worthy of this. And that is the grace of God, right? That's that was the thing that really made it make sense to me, is like, I don't deserve this, right? But it's not gonna stop me from like trying to pay it back. And so I just, you know, if the one thing that I could encourage folks to do is, like, you know, you don't have to get cancer, right, in order to, like, you know, do what you love. In fact, I mean, the people here probably are way, way further along that path than the vast majority of folks. Just even doing startups, right, is a, you know, huge step forward in that journey. But yeah. But I spent a lot of time thinking about that, obviously.
Going back to the previous question about, you know, what made you want to do something and use your skills to change the world, basically, how do you think we can help foster that here in Silicon Valley? Because I go to a lot of these events, I'm sure those people know more than me, but there's so many clones of Instagram and Pinterest and all that, and not that many people wanting to actually use their skills to do something like that. So how can we change that and, you know, foster this here?
So I actually don't think it's for a lack of desire. I think there's a lot of people here that want to change the world. The problem is as an entrepreneur, you're told, you know, solve the problem that you have, right? And the reality is that a lot of problems that people have when they come out of college is how to take pictures with different filters and how to find new music. I think there's a fair amount where, like, you know, and again, this goes back to the education question, right? It's like, you know, it have real problems, you know? That's actually the real, so dig into, like, you know, take anything that you're mildly interested in and, like, dig into it. Like, I completely left technology and started making movies, right? But I learned an awful lot about storytelling. And the connecting of those two things together, right? The internet with something else, I think is really powerful. So dive into things that are not tech and really try to understand them, and you'll bring the internet stuff that's baked into you, and you will look at that problem differently. Much of the great innovations that are happening are when people in completely different industries look at a problem that all the experts in the industry had looked at in a completely different way for a long time. And so, you know, I think there's a desire, a very strong, deep desire, right, within Silicon Valley to really, really change things. I think we don't know what all the problems are.
So you've touched on this a bit throughout the evening, but what do you feel that Nation Builder's successes have been as far as inciting people to action, whereas some other you know, tech platforms, social media platforms, have maybe not been as successful?
The thing that my favorite story success with Nation Builder was actually before we had even launched. Scottish National Party, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but they're a party in Scotland that has been for many years fighting for independence from the UK, to have their own nation. And we were just getting ready to launch it, but it was like in February of 2011. And we didn't launch until April. And I got this email from this guy, Kirk Torrance, and he'd been trying to get this Drupal and Civi CRM open source stuff working together. They've been working on it for over a year. But it wasn't ready, and their election was in 3 months. And they were down by 15 points in the polls. And so he came to me and he's like, hey, can we use Nation Builder? I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, it's not live yet. It's buggy as all get out. And it's certainly not ready for Scotland, right? So I'm like, okay, well, if I just show it how messy it is, how it won't work, then clearly they won't use it. So I went and I demoed it for their leadership team there. And I got the Skype call back like the next day, fully expecting to be like, hey, you know, sorry, it didn't work out. And they're like, nope, we want to use it. So we got them up in 2 weeks. And what they were able to do was there were all these folks who had been engaging around the Scottish National Party throughout the country on Twitter in particular that they never knew existed. And so what they did is they connected their accounts, and they started to see these super active people that had never been contacted by the party. So they saw these folks, these really active folks, and they started calling them. Say, hey, will you host a fundraiser? Hey, will you host a canvas? Right? And they were thrilled to death. No one from the party had ever contacted them. They grew their membership threefold in the course of the 3 months. They won a historic landslide victory, the first time any party had ever had control of the Scottish Parliament. It was totally shocking to all of Europe. They now have the ability and are going to hold a referendum on declaring independence from the Queen of England in the fall of 2014. I mean, it is quite literally nation building. I'm never telling anybody they can't use Nation Builder again. Was the big thing that I learned out of that. I think that we're just getting going. And if you think about what the internet can do, you know, what we saw happen, you know, with just using really rudimentary tools for organizing, like Facebook and Twitter, like in the Arab Spring, you know, I get really excited about sort of when we'll have multilingual versions of Nation Builder that work effectively in these other cultures and these other countries, because they're desperate for organizing tools. And they have to use things like Facebook and Twitter because anything that they set up themselves via open source software, whatever, that doesn't withstand the attacks from the government and from other forces. And so they've got to use commercial grade stuff, but the commercial grade stuff isn't designed for organizing. We had activists there had really significant problems where Facebook was constantly shut off their events and their pages because they were doing too many request invites and just things like that, just things that were just not designed for organizers. So I'm really excited about that, but that's my favorite story.
Yeah. When you're dealing with these different causes and they have obviously different budgets associated with the causes, like how do you determine when to charge and who to charge and how?
So we charge everybody, but we have this sliding scale. We call it pay-as-you-grow pricing. So it starts at $19 a month, And it's all based upon the number of people in your database. So if you've got a small, so you've got, you know, less than 1,000 people, you're paying like $19. If you've got millions of people, you're paying potentially thousands of dollars a month. So it just scales up. We have a very, very diverse and wide range of what customers pay us. But the idea is, like, as you're being more successful, you can afford to pay more, you can raise more money and stuff like that. It's a lot more affordable than anything like this has been in the past. And because you don't need this big tech team, it's like actually usable and doable by a lot of folks.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right. Can we get a round of applause for Jim to come around?